Hey, it's Callie, and you're listening to the 53rd episode of the Hippie Haven podcast. If you're new here, I release an episode every Wednesday related to living an ethical and eco-friendly lifestyle. My goal is to inspire you to take action, both in your day-to-day routine and on a larger scale of community activism, because I believe that together we'll make a difference. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe so that you automatically get each new episode right when it comes out. Today I'm chatting with Brendan Sinnott, the CEO of Pact, an organic clothing brand, and he's sharing his expertise on entrepreneurship from having started and sold multiple successful companies. We also discuss fair trade factories, cotton crops, and the number one thing he does to live as sustainably as possible. As always, you can find the show notes and transcript for this episode on my website, hippiehavenpodcast.com/053. Today's episode is brought to you by the Lemonade Boutique, a women's clothing with a cause store. Every item is ethically made by women overcoming extreme challenges, such as sex trafficking, abuse, addiction, and more. At the Lemonade Boutique, you can help these women take life's lemons and make lemonade. Shop online at www.thelemonadeboutique.com, and listeners of the Hippie Haven podcast can save 10% off your order by using the code HHP at checkout. As always, thank you for supporting our partners and helping us keep the mic on. You might have noticed there wasn't an episode last week, and that's because I'm currently making some big changes to the podcast. I've just hired a community manager. Her name is Kelly. And I know that's going to get confusing with Callie and Kelly, but Kelly is going to help bring to life my new vision for this platform. So we're working on that behind the scenes. I've still got a few pre-recorded episodes that are scheduled to publish throughout October while I'll be traveling in Europe. Once I'm back in South Dakota in November and Kelly has settled in, we'll be able to share these exciting changes. Y'all already know my life mission is to make a difference in the world, and we're about to get really clear and focus on exactly how we and you can do that. As always, thank you for supporting the work I do. Now for today's episode. How would you define or describe yourself?
I'm a dad. And I like to build a better version of stuff we use every day.
And tell me a little bit about your entrepreneurial background and what you did before starting Pact.
Yeah, I remember all the way back in middle school, being 10, 11, 12 years old, selling, like buying candy from a local Costco or Sam's Club and then selling out of my locker when I wasn't supposed to, just for the pure fun and game of it. And so, in high school, I had my own businesses where I'd make t-shirts for my sports teams, and I would wax people's cars when they left them at the train station. So I was always just like kind of into trying something. And then eventually when I was 23, I started a company called Bare Naked, which was a granola business with this whole idea. This was in 2002. All with the idea of like, why doesn't everybody understand what's in their food, how it's made? Why is there big cartoon characters on the front of my morning cereal? Like, that doesn't make any sense. And try to build a better version of cereal and snack food. And we eventually sold that to Kellogg's 5 years later, which was pretty cool because Kellogg's was the guy that actually invented granola. It was his first product. And then I took that experience. And then went on to start a frozen food business, a pet food business, and a candy business, as well as working on Pact.
And those other, the frozen food and that, were those successful businesses that you sold like you did with Bare Naked, or did you close those down?
We sold them all. So we sold the frozen food business to Pinnacle Foods, which is a very large food manufacturer. We sold our pet food business to a private equity firm, and the candy business we actually still own. We just started that a couple of years ago, so I still help support that as it's getting off the ground.
And what were some of the lessons that you learned from starting and then selling Bare Naked?
Oh, man. I think the biggest takeaway for me, and I started that company when I was 23. I'm 40 today. and just your relationship with risk as you age has been, you know, really interesting. I feel so fortunate that I was able to take a giant risk when it didn't cost me that much in my life, being in my early 20s when I started it. You know, when you're in your 20s, you have, if you don't have a family at that point, then you have nothing but energy and hard work to give, and a good spirit. You don't know all the answers. You're not educated in the best way to do things. But if you kind of take the right intention and dump everything into it, like, that's the time in life to go do it. I've continued to start businesses over time, and I have friends that start businesses, and the later you get into your career, the harder it is to take big risk, because you're giving up typically a lot more, from a professional standpoint, a personal standpoint. So I think that's to me, the biggest lesson in what I try to share with people, especially young folks, like, go take the risk early. It doesn't cost you anything.
Yeah. Now, before we jumped on this recording, I was reading a few articles about you, and one of them was talking about that time period as you were making that deal with Kellogg and signing it over, and how, you know, that was such a big monumental event for you, of course, this company that you started so young and put so much of yourself into, this organic granola, and how hard it was, how unsure you were. How did you feel about selling your organic granola company to, you know, this big food giant Kellogg? Did you ever feel like you were selling out by giving it to this non-organic, non-sustainable company?
Yeah, you definitely, you know, in order to build a business, you have investors, and those investors have expectations about getting their money back one day. So there's a certain just reality of starting a business. And if you want to start one at scale, unless you have all the money yourself, you have to earn a return for people. So that's part of building businesses, overall, you know, in terms of selling to Kellogg's. When I started it, the day I began, I was like, I want to go sell this to Kellogg's one day, because if I am able to go build up a business and do it in a way that I believe is right, and then I'm proud to share with my family, and I make the product the right way, and I use ingredients that people can understand, and then I can scale that commercially to the point where Kellogg's does want to buy it, then I've basically taken this idea of natural and organic, and I've taken it to the masses, and I can take it so far, they could take it even further, right? They, you know, so when they bought Bare Naked, we were actually bought a brand named Kashi, which a lot of people are familiar with. We actually kind of nested underneath Kashi, which was also owned by Kellogg's at the time. Kashi is the largest natural food brand, organic food brand at the time. So, you know, with my hope when I sold it was that we are going to give them this idea, and this consumer base and these products, and that they would be able to take that to more and more people, and introduce organic and natural cereal to more people for the first time, through their distribution in a way that I never could, because we're not a 100-year-old company. And so that, you know, that was the mindset. There was a giant for me, like, it was so bittersweet, because there was huge financial rewards from it. But you know, the first, you know, seven people at the company, four I went to high school with, one was my college roommate. So like the people that built this company, there's, you know, yes, you have fun doing it, but you also do it with people that you love, and it becomes this family unit. And seeing that kind of eventually disband was like the biggest heartache of the whole thing, because, you know, working with people you love and doing it every day is such a gift.
And where did you get the idea for Pact?
Pact, I a long time ago met Calvin Klein and saw the brand and the products and the legacy that he all built, and kind of admired it. And then I had been in the food space for a number of years, and I just kind of started to think about apparel. And to me, everything that I've worked on is something that's on my body or in my body every day. So I give it to my kids every day. So I, you know, you give dog food to your dog every day. Granola, you pretty much eat every day. So I've really tried to work on stuff that where consumers have a deeper relationship with it. And clothing to me is such an expression of self, and it's something that touches your skin and is with you day in and day out, and you make a choice to put it on every day. So it felt like a very rich environment to, you know, basically change the conversation around not like what are you wearing, but like how is it, how is what you're wearing made? what impact did it make? And I got really interested in looking at cotton specifically, because cotton, something like 25% of the world's pesticides are sprayed on cotton fields, yet it only consumes like 7% of the land. It's a super heavily chemicalized and industrialized crop that pollutes a lot. And, you know, and then you start to see cotton farmers with masks on because they're spraying pesticides and it's right in the air around their families. And the whole thing just felt like actually a real problem. And then cotton specifically is something that it's like truly the fabric of our lives. We sleep in it. We wash ourselves off when we get out of the shower with it. We normally wear it for underwear. We probably have it in our jeans. We probably have it in our hoodie. And, you know, it's all, it's the majority of what's in your closet is likely cotton. So there's a real problem around it. So that started to really interest me because I could take a lot of the same learnings I had within the food space and apply it to cotton from a environmental and sustainability standpoint. Because, you know, your clothing, people don't realize, is your clothing's grown just like your food is. It's actually probably grown in the same fields as your food. So can we treat it the same way?
And so from day one, you've been focused with PACT on organic cotton, and you've talked about the pesticides. What about some of the other benefits of organic versus conventional cotton, like in terms of land use and crop yield and water? Why was organic cotton the choice for you in those aspects?
Yeah, cotton's a very thirsty crop, particularly when it's genetically modified. And so organic cotton uses something like 80% less water than conventional cotton. A lot of that's based upon the fact that it's grown in rain-fed areas. We buy all of our cotton from India, and the organic cotton is grown from rain-fed mountainous areas within India, where there's a lot of kind of small plot farmers. So think, you know, 3 acres to 10 acres is what an average person owns. It's not like giant industrial lots over there growing organic cotton specifically. So you get the very real benefits of less chemicals, less toxicity. There's less pollution associated with it from a water standpoint. But what the part that absolutely blew my mind was when I went over to India. We go do this trip a couple of times a year. We were bringing the Whole Foods team and the Target buyers over to India with us to go show them how we do it ourselves. And you go into the farmland, and it feels like you're going back in time. You know, these people live in mud huts. They have no electricity. They depend on their land to sustain their whole family and their community. They don't go outside of it. And so we visited both places where those farmers were farming conventionally, and you can see them again spraying pesticides and doing these things that just I wouldn't want to leave my family there knowing the truth around it. And then you see the folks that are growing organic cotton, and then how they're rotating the crops within their fields, how they're creating their own fertilizers, they're creating their own pesticides from natural sources, and they're getting a premium for doing that, and they're using less water. And so there's a besides the environmental piece specifically within cotton, and specifically within India, there's a huge people element of it that is incredibly impactful to communities in ways that people don't typically think about when they think about organic farming.
And your organic cotton fabric is GOTS certified. What does that mean?
So in the United States, if you go buy an organic banana, you'll see the USDA seal on the outside of it that says this item is certified by the U.S. government to meet the organic certifications and standards set forth. And that's kind of the reason for us to believe that it's organic. In clothing, the USDA doesn't regulate it. because it's not consumed. So what the USDA has said is, in order for you to sell an organic product within apparel or textiles, you need to have it GOTS certified. So it's the equivalent certification that you would go through to sell a banana, but by an organization that's based in Europe that does that for the whole world.
And what are the requirements for the farmers to be certified under that organization?
It's the same requirements as you would have to be USDA organic in the U.S. So not using things like Roundup in your fields to kill weeds. And there's a list of, you know, probably 100 chemicals, ingredients, and things like that that you can't use from a farming standpoint as you're growing the cotton. And then there's organizations that we depend on in India specifically that works with the cooperatives of these folks to help provide them the right organic seed and give them the right procedures and techniques that are relevant to where they're actually farming to yield the best crops.
How does your company source fabrics? Are you working directly with individual farmers, or are you going through a distributor company or something like that?
There's a cotton cooperative. There's a couple of them. There's one named Chetna, which is based in India, and they're a cooperative that has about 10,000 farmers in it. So we buy a lot of cotton from them, and there's a second cooperative that works with the one of our other factories within India. So we don't buy direct. We're not going, you know, 3 acre plot by 3 acre plot and buying the cotton from those people individually and transacting at. All of that community works with a cooperative. In the same way, kind of in the U.S., if you buy milk, you don't buy it from the individual farmer, you buy it from the cooperative. It's a kind of similar type of structure, so that the farmers have basically an entity representing them to the marketplace.
And why did you decide to manufacture in India versus, say, right here in the U.S.?
It's not possible in the U.S., both in terms of the amount of organic cotton, as well as, again, if you were to go make a pair of underwear in the U.S., the consumer will, you know, likely pay $15 to $20 for it. If you make a pair of organic underwear in India, you know, we sell our underwear 2 for $10. So the same price that you'd be buying, products from J. Crew or Victoria's Secret or whatever it is, but because we sell direct to consumer, we're really efficient in it. And because we've been working on we've only ever made organic cotton products, we've been working at it for 10 years. We've gotten to a scale where we can kind of hit that price point for the consumer, because what we found is most consumers don't want to pay more to do the right thing, but they're willing to pay the same to do the right thing overall.
And a lot of your apparel items are fair trade certified. What does that mean exactly?
Yeah, so when we think about building apparel or clothes in a better way, there's two components of it for us. The first is we think like better ingredients make a better product. So that's, you know, better. That's how when we think about organic cotton or recycled poly or other fabric or other fibers. And then the second part is this idea that, like, kind of those who make the product are equal to those who wear the product. This idea that the people that make our product should be treated in a fair way. So that's after the cotton is grown and it's turned into threads, and then at the factory level, it's turned into a fabric, and then the fabric needs to be cut and sewn together in order to make a piece of clothing. So that cut and sewing that happens at the factory level, we utilize fair trade to make sure that women are treated fairly, that the wages are right, that the overall factory environment is a place that has a higher ethical standard. And we think fair trade kind of has the highest ethical standard for international factories that we found. And quite honestly, we piggybacked a lot on what Patagonia pioneered as we look at them as one of the gold standards.
Yeah, Patagonia is fantastic. So you've obviously put so much thought into all of these different aspects. So I would definitely assume you've probably put a lot of thought into the dyes that you're using to color your clothes as well. Can you tell me more about that dyeing process?
Yeah, the dyeing process is all governed by GOTS. So, you know, in order to call it a garment organic, not only do you have to grow the fiber organically, but then when you dye it, you can't use, you know, for instance, like toxic metals to go dye your fabrics. So there's again, from an organic standpoint, there's a list of chemicals or ingredients or agents that you're not able to use on your fabric. So sometimes what that actually means for us is sometimes people will buy a t-shirt and they'll have like a really nice hand feel that's kind of, you know, has a specific texture and it's rough, and they'll be like, oh, that's beautiful, I want that. But we can't actually go make that, because that's the way you get that hand feel is by using agents or toxic dyes that are not allowed from the organic standard. So that's kind of one thing, is like you cannot use toxic dyes through the organic process. The second thing is at the plant level, we focus on utilizing dye houses that recycle a lot of their own water and clean their own water. Typically, textile production is I think the second largest polluter of water in the world. And it's a lot of it's because of the dyeing process that occurs. And then the discharge from those dye houses going into public water systems, especially in kind of second, third world countries where it's not as regulated. And so, you know, we leverage kind of the GOTS standard to make sure we're not dyeing it with nasty stuff, and to make sure that the dye houses are not polluting the environment as part of their waste discharge.
What are your recommendations for washing and caring for articles of clothing to maximize their lifetime?
Wash cold, ideally air dry or kind of low temp dry if you're going to use a washing machine. And, you know, wear it. You don't wash it unless you have to. You know, if you can use a towel twice instead of using it once, you know, that obviously helps from a wear standpoint.
And so what tips do you have for people who might want to start their own clothing brands? What lessons have you learned? What obstacles, unexpected obstacles, did you overcome, and advice that you have?
I think, you know, coming out of the food space, clothing and apparel is far more complicated because of the amount of individual items that you have to go sell. So it's not like you're just selling a hoodie. You're selling a hoodie. You got to sell it in six sizes. So it's six different items. And then you're going to go sell it in six different colors. That's 36 different items. So there's a tremendous amount of complexity with the assortment. You know, overall, which makes the business kind of complicated. And then for us, we sell, you know, the majority of our business is direct to consumer. So you just go on wearpack.com and you buy products from us. And so we don't just have a store that we have to put all that stuff in. We have to then go figure out how to sell it digitally. Those are kind of the large challenges that we see kind of day in and day out. And then there's also just the subjective nature of fit. So, you know, that fits you, but it doesn't fit somebody else. And trying to understand, you know, what your perspective is on that, and kind of, you know, who is the ultimate muse that you're building all your product portfolio to, and kind of staying diligent around staying true to that.
And how is PACT funded?
PACT's been funded by myself, and then actually by a partner of ours that bought our frozen food company a number of years ago. So we kind of own it, and I'm lucky enough to run it also.
And you've started so many different businesses. So along that same line of people who are interested in starting some sort of eco-friendly, sustainable clothing brand, what advice do you have for startup funding for that?
I mean, it's so cool to see how much has changed since, you know, the first time I was trying to raise money from investors was, you know, 18 years ago. And it was calling my friend's parents saying, hey, I'm starting this granola company. Do you want to invest? And at that point, you know, people are just kind of investing in you. They're not really investing in the idea because it's not totally baked. But today there's crowdfunding, there's, you know, multiple marketplaces. You can go online to meet different investors. There is, you know, multiple kind of credit opportunities. So I think starting a business from a funding standpoint today feels much easier than it did, you know, 15, 20 years ago. Just with there's so many different creative ways to create the opportunity for a business to grow today. But the, you know, the biggest thing is for me when I was starting up, I was like, everybody that I took money from, I was like, I want you to expect that I'm going to lose this money for you. That's like, let's just start there. And then if I give you something back, it's a nice surprise. But I don't want to take your money unless you plan to lose it all. So that we kind of just set that expectation from day one. Because a lot of times when you start businesses, it's, you know, you're getting funded by personal relationships or family or friends. So just to kind of set that bar extremely low. And if somebody still wants in, then they want in for the right reasons and it won't be hard later in case it doesn't work.
And Pact recently branched out and launched a bedding line as well. What was the inspiration behind taking down that avenue, and what makes your bedding line stand out from the other ones already on the market?
Yeah. So our bedding, most people sleep in cotton sheets. So ours are 100% organic cotton sheets. Ours are also made in fair trade factories. And we have two or three different varieties. We have kind of like a favorite t-shirt that feels like an old t-shirt. And then we also have a kind of a more classic kind of, if you go to a nicer hotel and we call it like kind of room service sheet, you know, it's got a kind of a sateen feel. So they're super soft. Everything that we make, like we can't make it unless it's super soft and you want to touch it every day. You know, that's kind of, for us, we don't want to make a product unless we can hit that mark. And then, you know, the why was, you know, I wear organic cotton now all day, whether it's my underwear, or my pants or my hoodie or my t-shirt or whatever it may be. And you know, why not sleep in it also, was kind of the basic idea. If I'm in it all day, why not be in it all night?
And what's next for Pact?
We're continuing to improve our products. You know, we work on getting better on that every day. You know, that's something we're committed to. We are continuing to expand our business in Whole Foods and places like that, where we're getting more and more products available there. And just really continuing to kind of, for us, you know, so much of what we're trying to do is this idea of like changing the conversation around what's in people's closets. And the next big thing that I want to go work on, is kind of building that content and building that community and pushing that forward digitally, even if somebody doesn't buy our product. Because I think we can all make a big impact. If we look at our closet the same way we look at our refrigerator or our kitchen, we can make it a better place, a better planet, treat people better. And that's what we want to ultimately, what we're all about. So how do we go do that through community and through content?
My last question for you, what is your number one tip for living an ethical and eco-friendly lifestyle?
I try not to own a car and try to live close to where I work and then bike or walk. You know, that for me has the benefit of the environmental impact. It has the benefit of being cheaper, and it has the benefit of feeling healthier. So I think if more people were able to do that, it's a great way to kind of get three birds with one stone.
Absolutely. Yeah. Transportation industry is huge. It's just, unfortunately here in America, we don't have a great infrastructure for that shared public transportation, or bicycling can be difficult in a lot of areas. So there's definitely still work to be done there.
We are so lucky here in Boulder, Colorado. Like, the bike system is awesome, and it makes the whole community healthier. So, you know, ask your local representatives to invest in that part of your infrastructure for sure.
If you find value in the Hippie Haven podcast, please share it with someone you know who'd be interested. You can leave a review on iTunes or whichever podcast app you're using, and also consider buying me a virtual cup of coffee to keep me going. Each podcast episode takes around 6 hours to create, and episodes cost about $50 each out of my own pocket. These costs include file hosting, editing, transcription for people who need or prefer visual content, and my own time of researching, drafting, recording, proofing, and promoting. Visit buymeacoffee.com/Callie, that's C-A-L-L-E-E, to support the work I'm doing with a $4 cup of coffee. Thank you all from the bottom of my heart for spending this time with me, and I hope you have a great rest of your day.